Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There were big doings on Wahlstrasse today. The NYSE got bought out by Deutsche Börse because the global marketplace isn't just stocks and bonds anymore, you know. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
What does Tier 1 capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Tuesday, everybody. It's the 15th of February today, and I have to tell you, stocks are just so yesterday. You can trade them pretty much anywhere. Everybody who wants to be in the market is in the market, and they're just not profitable for stock exchanges to handle anymore. And that is how the New York Stock Exchange came to agree to a takeover today. The board of the NYSE, formerly the company name is NYSE Euronext, approved a buyout by Germany's Deutsche Börse. The NYSE is going to set its sights on more complicated and profitable products like derivatives and options, but that doesn't necessarily mean Auf Wiedersehen to everyday investors, as our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore reports.
Some people are afraid that the New York Stock Exchange may have to drop the word New York from its name now that it's owned by Germans. The bigger problem is that it may have to drop the words stock exchange. The stock trading business is less profitable these days. High-speed computer traders dominate the market and have pushed others out. Here's Larry Tabb, the founder of a firm that analyzes stock markets.
The economics of the exchange business has radically changed.
Tabb says stock exchanges have to pay more attention now to futures and other derivatives that will be a growing market for them. The Dodd-Frank financial reforms this year pushed the markets to trade more derivatives on exchanges. So they're leaving stocks behind. Sal Arnuk, who founded Themis Trading, notes that the push towards derivatives comes as retail investors have shied away from stocks because they feel the odds are stacked against them.
Investors are discouraged because it's not an even playing field. You have long-term investors and hyper-short-term nano-traders. And the hyper-short-term nano-traders are 75% of the volume in the market.
The NYSE might be at the forefront of another trend. Arnuk and Tabb believe regular investors won't want to be left behind forever. Eventually, they'll look to buy and sell more exotic financial products that once were left to the pros, like swaps to trade foreign currencies.
Instead of trading Oracle, they will be able to trade swaps from their online account. If this is not scary, it should be.
That may be a future concern. For now, the NYSE and Deutsche Börse have to figure out a name. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
There's some bad news and there's some good news for Chevron today. The bad news you may have heard already. The company's on the hook for $9 billion in Ecuador. A judge there ruled that Texaco, which has since been bought up by Chevron, didn't do near enough to clean up some chemical sludge it dumped into the Amazon basin 40 years ago. The good news is that lawyers for the plaintiffs, the Ecuadorian winners in this case, said they won't try to collect until Chevron's run through all its appeals. That, of course, could take years, which does raise the question of billable hours and how little guy plaintiffs can afford to keep up a long legal fight like this. Well, how about with a little help from a big hedge fund? From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
Need a loan? We're here to help. That's the pitch that British fund Burford Capital made to the plaintiffs fighting Chevron. Law professor Robert Percival at the University of Maryland says the funders looked at the case and placed a bet.
Investors were willing to step in and help fund the litigation because they anticipated that it would produce results.
Fidelity and Invesco are among the institutional investors with money on the line against Chevron. No word on how much, but it's deep in the pockets of the plaintiffs in a case now going on 18 years.
Even if you're poor, you have a better chance of being able to litigate it no matter how much the defendant has.
Lawsuit lending emerged in the last decade in the U.S. There are highbrow Wall Street financiers and guys who advertise on late-night cable, like 1-800-LAW-CASH.
The real reason that you should be using LawCash is our people.
Critics see these outfits as modified loan sharks. They back cases, and if they win, demand a big cut.
20 to 50% wouldn't be an unusual amount.
Attorney Anna Pertoldi at the firm Herbert Smith says her door gets knocked on a lot by aspiring fund managers.
Basically looking for cases with very good prospects of success.
Still, without these funders, some litigants would have to fold up on account of no more dough. By all accounts, lawsuit finance is a growing field. The fundamentals of the suing industry appear solid. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
President Obama took to the podium this morning to defend his budget. He's been getting it from both sides of the aisle for taking only a tepid stab at the huge financial hole the federal government has dug. Fact is, though, that almost whatever was in that budget yesterday was going to be criticized. But the president already had a bipartisan roadmap for fixing the big problems, a roadmap that he mostly ignored. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
Remember the president's Fiscal Reform Commission? Back in December, it produced a roadmap for bringing deficits under control. There were tough spending cuts, entitlement, and tax reforms. At the time, President Obama praised the commission's work, but very little of it ended up in yesterday's budget. When the president's budget director went to Capitol Hill this morning, the Republican committee chairman, Paul Ryan, wanted to know what happened.
I think the fact that the president even gave us this fiscal commission to start with acknowledged we agree on the size and the scope and the nature of the problem. Why did you duck? Why are you not taking this opportunity to lead?
Down the street at a White House news conference, Obama insisted he still values the commission's plan.
The notion that it's been shelved, I think, is incorrect. It still provides a framework for a conversation.
A conversation, he says, that'll take some time. But former Congressional Budget Office Director Rudolph Penner says time is running out.
If he had just a little more courage, he would have talked more about the seriousness of the budget problem. He's been extremely politically cautious, but I would argue he's also been very reckless with the economy.
Because if there's not a plan soon to attack the long-term deficit, Penner says buyers of the federal government's debt will look elsewhere. Overall, foreign investments are up, but just this week, China announced it was scaling back U.S. bond buying for the second month in a row. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Speaking of scaling back buying, traders on Wall Street took a breather today and the major indices sagged. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Hillary Clinton has 62,000 or so followers on Twitter. And had you been following the Secretary of State's feed today, State Dept, I believe, is the Twitter handle, you'd have gotten the skinny on the Obama administration's new plan for Internet freedom. Clinton gave a big speech in Washington this morning in which she announced that the State Department is going to start spending real cash to help online activists break free from government censors and online surveillance. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Clinton said the State Department would spend $25 million this year helping human rights activists around the globe evade internet firewalls, defeat government censors, and avoid online surveillance. The program could even teach activists how to purge their cell phones of sensitive data if they're being taken into custody.
We are taking a venture capital style approach, supporting a portfolio of technologies, tools, and training.
The money for this has been sitting around at State for more than a year. Recent events in the Middle East and Egypt may have helped move it out the door. Many activists, though, are frustrated the State Department's not spending all of this money attacking internet firewalls, the barriers that censor information flowing into countries like Iran and China. Clinton, though, argued there's no magic app for internet freedom.
We have our ear to the ground talking to digital activists about where they need help. And our diversified approach means we're able to adapt to the range of threats that they face.
I think that's exactly right. You do need a broad-based approach.
Timothy Carr is at the Save the Internet Coalition. He welcomes the State Department's cash, but doesn't think this will be enough. And the West, he says, may be fighting itself. Carr says many U.S. and Western firms are selling powerful surveillance technology to oppressive regimes.
That in the wrong hands can be used to crack down against these sort of democracy movements worldwide.
Carr says if the State Department's serious about internet freedom, it should take a long, hard look at these deals. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Starting in Tunisia, and to a degree in Egypt, and now certainly the past few days in Iran and Bahrain, governments in the Middle East have tried to keep a lid on the pro-democracy protests with violence. Police officers and soldiers have been deployed in that effort. But the governments have also been turning to fiscal policy of a sort. In Jordan, they've been throwing public money at protesters in the hopes they'll just go away. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now from Amman.
It's the oldest trick in the book. The Romans called it bread and circuses. Stuff the people with food or line their pockets with cash and hope that will placate them. The same is happening today across the Arab world.
All of the governments in the Middle East are using the money and distributing money nowadays in order to calm the people.
Mohammed Al-Masri of the University of Jordan says Arab governments had been slashing public spending and cutting subsidies. But suddenly, austerity is going out of style. Largesse is all the rage.
Let's give the people money. The people will be calm and they are not going to question our authority. They are not going to talk about their basic freedoms and political freedoms. It is a form of a bribe.
The most blatant example is in Kuwait. The small, immensely wealthy, oil-rich sheikhdom is giving every one of its citizens $3,500 and free food for a year. But everyone is at it, says economist Ibrahim Saif, including dirt-poor countries with little or no oil.
In Jordan, immediately the response was to increase the public servant wages by not significant amount, but that was the response. And there was also a decision not to continue on cutting subsidies.
That will set the Jordanian government back $500 million, which it can ill afford. Syria can't afford its largesse either. Raising its heating fuel subsidy by 72% will cost a fortune. This spending spree cannot go on, says Saif.
It's not sustainable because most of the countries now, of the Arab countries, are running huge budget deficit. They are slowing down in their economic performance.
Many commentators here believe that even the oil-rich countries that can easily afford the extra spending won't get a return on their money. They won't deflect dissent. Take the relatively prosperous nation of Bahrain in the Persian Gulf. It promised every household a gift of $3,000, but the protests rage on. Mohammed Al-Masri says what the Bahrainis want is democracy.
They are not looking for more cash in their pockets. They want to be partners in the decision-making process.
The protests sweeping across the Arab world may have been triggered by economic concerns, rising food prices, stratospheric unemployment. But now, claims magazine owner Mustafa Khamenei, it's developed into a full-blown revolution that won't be stilled by a splurge in public spending.
To resort to these measures show that these regimes are really historically trapped. And when the conditions develop in these societies for change, it's unstoppable.
But can governments with enough money smother the urge for freedom and democracy? Saudi Arabia will be the ultimate test. If the unrest breaks out there, in a country with an estimated 20% of the world's known oil reserves, the effects will be felt around the globe. In Amman, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up, name, place, and length.
Name, Baghdad Wall. Country, Iraq. Built, year, under construction. Length, 5 kilometres. Name, Belfast Peace Lines. Country, Northern Ireland. Built, year, 1970s. Length, 0.5 kilometres.
A look at man-made barriers coming up, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials ditched 41 points today, about a 3%, closed at 12,226. The NASDAQ off 12 points. That's almost a 0.5%, closed at 2804. The S&P 500 gave up 4 points. 3%, met the bell at 1328. Bad day for big oil. ExxonMobil dried up more than 2.25% today. Investors siphoned off almost 0.67% from Chevron. ConocoPhillips dribbled down about 0.3% as well. Over to tech, shares of Hewlett-Packard and Google each drained down about 0.67%. Microsoft sputtered down 0.4%. Apple did manage to pick up 0.2%. Meantime, investors didn't seem too thrilled with the merger between the New York Stock Exchange and Deutsche Börse. Shares of NYSE Euronext dropped 0.75% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.60% on the nose. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for January. The Labor Department releases the Producer Price Index for January. And the Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee holds a hearing titled Safeguarding Our Future, Building a Nationwide Network for First Responders. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The common economic threat across a lot of the Middle East the past couple of weeks has been jobs. Frustrated young people who are unemployed and without much prospect of getting ahead. You keep going east around the globe, though, and you'll see similar problems in a place you might not expect. For all its economic growth, China has a big unemployment problem, and it's the young and educated who are being hit the hardest. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz is on the line from Shanghai with more on that. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Kai.
I was saying China's got an unemployment problem, but if you look at the actual numbers, like I did just before I came in here, urban unemployment in China last year, 4.1%, which actually sounds pretty good.
Doesn't sound too bad. Now, that's what's called the urban registered unemployment rate. I emphasize registered because it only counts people who officially live in urban areas. Many people are off the books. These are the hundreds of millions of migrant workers who move to the cities, and they make up a huge labor pool. So when you factor in that population, China's actual unemployment rate comes out to be 22%. That's around 200 million people who don't have work.
Okay, so that's a problem. But when you say migrant workers, I'm thinking the guys who come in from the countryside to do manual labor.
Actually, those are the people finding jobs these days because fewer people are willing to do that kind of work. There's a new population of migrants in China, and they're young college graduates. There are six times the number of college grads nowadays than there were a decade ago, and many of them are from the countryside. Urban Chinese have a funny name for them. They call them Yizu, the ant colony. They're called that because after they move to the big city, they tend to live together in these cramped neighborhoods like ants. And they're all looking for work. Problem is, they're not finding it. Nearly a quarter of last year's graduates haven't found jobs.
Why not? What's going on? I mean, the economy's booming.
Right. Part of the problem is that there's a big disconnect between how China's colleges are preparing its young people and the reality of China's economy. China's economy is still mostly dependent on manufacturing and building things. At the same time, you've got 6 million college students a year graduating with degrees in everything from the sciences to the liberal arts. And China's economy simply hasn't evolved to the point where enough employers are looking for workers with those skills. So for all you liberal arts majors out there, here's yet another economy where you really won't fit in very well.
Well, let's say that point again. The best educated Chinese, the youngest, most energetic Chinese don't have a place in the Chinese economy.
Yeah, that's right. And even those who do find work aren't finding jobs they've studied 4 years for. I had lunch this week with a guy named Ming. He graduated a few years ago from university here in Shanghai. He majored in Japanese, and he was hoping to find a job translating for a Japanese company. But the competition was really stiff. So instead, Ming's parents used their connections to land him a job in a state-owned enterprise. He was making $300 a month for basically sitting around reading books and surfing the web.
That was his whole job, just doing that?
Ming's job was supposed to be selling sports equipment, but he said he never had any customers, so he just sat around all day. After 2 years of this, he was bored out of his mind, so he quit and took a job with a public relations firm. Now he makes even less money, but instead of surfing the web when he's supposed to be working, now his work is surfing the web. He gets paid to find blogs and websites that criticize his clients' products. His clients then use that information to improve their product.
Is he using the Japanese degree that he got?
He's not using it at all. And, you know, he told me that he wishes he could have added another major, something like information technology, to make himself more marketable. But as a general rule, colleges in China don't allow students to do that, so they're stuck with one discipline. I asked him if he ever considered working construction, because construction work pays at least twice as much as he's making now. He said his parents wouldn't let him because they considered it a shameful job. You know, and that's the other problem. Like nearly everyone else his age in China, Ming's an only child, and the pressure from his parents is not helping. In fact, Ming's girlfriend just broke up with him because her parents thought he wasn't making enough money. So this guy's got pressure from all sides, and he's fairly miserable as a result. And the thing is, there are millions of young Chinese just like him.
Rob Schmitz in Shanghai with a story of the Chinese labor market. Rob, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
You could say, if you wanted to mix your metaphors, that Greece is the European Union's Arizona. Much as a healthy portion of illegal immigration to the United States comes over the Arizona-Mexico border, so is the small Mediterranean country the backdoor into Europe for 90% of the continent's illegal immigrants. Many of them make their way in through a 7.5-mile stretch of farm fields on the Greek border with Turkey. And much like in Arizona, that's where Greece wants to build a border fence. Joanna Kakisis reports.
Nadir Abdelawa is 37 and has a college degree. But back home in Algeria, the only steady work he could find was selling fake designer clothes on the black market. And even then, he could barely get by.
You can't go up. Sometimes you can't find money to buy potatoes or bread or something like that.
He'd heard the jobs were in Europe, so he took a cheap flight to Istanbul. Then he paid a smuggler about $540 to help him slip into Greece on a foggy morning. Border police found him in a nearby train station. They took him to a detention center near the city of Orestiada. Abdelawa is out now and planning to walk nearly 600 miles to Athens. And if he gets a chance, he'll leave Greece and head to a richer European country.
If I get a chance to go out the country, I do. If not, I'm looking for a job. I don't dream like I'm a rich man next time. No, just job, house, wife, that's it.
Abdelawa walks down a country road with an Afghan mechanic, a Sudanese accountant, and three men from Pakistan. They all dream of jobs that pay in euros. But the reality is that many migrants will end up trapped and jobless in Athens. Public Order Minister Christos Papoutsis says the country is broke and just doesn't have the resources to help them. That's why he wants to block the path with a border fence. The fence is months away from being built. The Greek and European border guards who patrol the area say they can't catch everyone. Fotis Papazoglou is a border policeman. He says the fence will be a barrier.
Now they have nothing to disturb them. They just walk and pass. It's not a problem for them. It's much more easier.
The crossing can be dangerous. Orestiada Police Chief George Salamangas shows photographs of immigrants who have drowned in the Evros River, which divides Greece and Turkey. But he also shows videos of men in suits strolling into Greek cornfields.
Many of the immigrants tell us they're Palestinian or Somalian so they can get asylum. But we have interpreters who can figure out where they're really from.
Many are actually Tunisian, Moroccan, and Algerian. But Salamangas says there are also a growing number of Afghans. Farouk Aktash owns a clock shop in Edirne, a Turkish city near the Greek border. He often sees foreigners with torn clothes and big backpacks walking the streets here. He says they're determined to get to Greece.
They're hungry, and some even tried to cross the border by swimming across it. They're willing to die.
About 7 miles away in the Greek village of Neavisa, a group of grandfathers sip coffee at a cafe owned by Christos Kyriakidis. Most mornings, he says immigrants camp out at the train station across the street.
Greece is like an unguarded vineyard. It's vulnerable, and those who want to get in here are taking advantage of it. Even now, they're coming in big groups.
It's cold these days, and some of the immigrants don't have shoes or coats. Kyriakidis says he feels bad for them and brings them milk, bread, and coffee. But lately, he says he's been running low on supplies. He wonders if soon he'll just have to stop sharing. In Orestiada, Greece, I'm Joanna Kakissis for Marketplace.
Walls like the one Joanna was just telling us about are more popular than you might think. All over the world, countries have built separation barriers to try to control war or terrorism or ethnic and religious conflicts, as well as immigration. Niall Farrell produced a documentary that lists a lot of those barriers, where they were built, when they were built, how long they are, and what they were built for.
Name: Baghdad Wall. Country: Iraq. Built: year under construction. Length: 5 kilometers. Type: civil pacification. Name: Belfast Peace Lines. Country: Northern Ireland. Built: year 1970s. Length: 0.5 kilometers. Average: type: civil pacification. Name: Ceuta border fence. Country: Spain and Morocco. Built: year 2001. Length: 8 kilometers. Type: anti illegal immigration. Name: China North Korea barrier. Country: China and North Korea. Built: year under construction. Length: 1416 kilometers. Type: anti illegal immigration. Name: Egypt Gaza barrier. Country: Egypt and Palestinian territories. Built: year 1979. Length: 3.071 kilometers. Type: anti terrorism and illegal immigration. name Indian Kashmir Barrier, country India, built year 2004, length 550 kilometers, type and a terrorism name Indo-Bangladesh Barrier, country India and Bangladesh, built year under construction, length 3268 kilometers, type and a illegal immigration name Iran-Pakistan border, country Iran and Pakistan.
Niall Farrell produced his piece on separation barriers for a documentary competition at the Third Coast Audio Festival. You can hear the whole thing, runs about 3 minutes, and read a list of the places those barriers sit on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, picking up where Heidi Moore left off, what we're going to call the New York Stock Exchange now that it's owned by the Germans, except it's not really owned by the Germans. Here's the deal. The two biggest shareholders of Deutsche Börse are American. They're U.S. mutual fund companies. And it's not like the NYSE wasn't already international. You remember the Euronext part of that name? That's from a merger 3 years ago with exchanges in Paris and Brussels and Amsterdam. So, still, what to call the Deutsche Börse NYSE Euronext building at the corner of Wall Street and Broad? That, I don't know. Send us your suggestions. Letters, marketplace.org. You know what to do. And that, on this Tuesday, is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow gave back about 41 points, a third of 1%. The NASDAQ shed 12 points, almost a half percent. The S&P 500 lost 4 points. That is a third of 1%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Bead. And that is where you can tune tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time back on The Big Show, some advice to American drug companies. If you want to do business in Russia, you got to be in Russia.
If you construct your factory in Russia, you will have better conditions for your business activity in this country.
Not a threat at all. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.